This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day and thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. It was a big week for sport this week with Tim Cahill doing Australia proud with that killer goal in the World Cup and a long-awaited victory for the Blues in State of Origin. Scott Jackson from Sky News Sport relives all the action. This week, the court found it is legal to process asylum seekers offshore. Greg Lake, former Director of Regional and Offshore Processing with the Department of Immigration, gives his view on what the government should do next now that they've stopped the boats. Last week, a giant balloon of Jesus the Redeemer was promoting betting on the World Cup. According to Jared Byrne, coordinator of problem gambling services with the Salvos, events like the World Cup do lead to a spike in gambling activity. He talks about the impact of problem gambling on Australian families. It's Drug Action Week. Dr. Peter Gates from the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre gives us the facts about the illicit drug most likely to be used by young people. Andrew Morris highlights the latest trends in internet use and technology, and Mark Hadley reviews the new DreamWorks animation, How to Train Your Dragon 2. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast.
The ball's dangerous. Oh! Tim Cahill. Can you believe it? He's done it again. Tim Cahill equalises for Australia and produces another golden moment in World Cup football.
There are a lot of sleep-deprived sports lovers slumping over their desks today, but one of those who sacrificed sleep for the love of sport is Scott Jackson from Sky News Sport. Hi, Scott.
G'day, Katrina.
Now, State of Origin last night, I have to say, I only caught the last 20 minutes, but that turned out to be the right 20 minutes. I believe you were actually there for the very exciting finish?
Well, I wasn't actually there. I'm just covering it this morning for Sky News, waiting for the players to come out of their hotels after a big night. But as you can imagine, they did have quite a big night, and I think some of them are still in debt at the moment, but
fair enough.
As they come out. But yeah, I'll tell you what a result last night for New South Wales. I think relief is the best way to describe it after 8 long years for Queensland. So it was a low-scoring match and a pretty scrappy one too, but New South Wales won't care in the slightest. They got the result, and that's all that matters. No matter what happens in Game 3 in 3 weeks, Paul Gowan with that trophy in Queensland. It has been a long time coming.
Yes. Now, there was a bit of biffo too between Jonathan Thurston and Josh Reynolds in that sort of exciting last part of the game. I noticed that they even made up though after the game. So it's been pretty good feeling this morning.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, the rugby league brought in the rule that you throw a punch and you get sent to the sin bin. So there were quite a few moments there where if what had happened last night had happened last year or in previous years, punches would have been thrown for sure. But the rule seems to have worked because players rush in, push and shove, but don't really throw punches, and there wasn't any offence. But you're right, there was a lot of niggle.
I wonder if they're actually trying to get the other guy to throw a punch so he'll get sent off. I wonder if there was a bit of stirring up going on there. Come on, give it a go.
They're all waiting for someone to throw the first punch. I'm sure if someone throws a punch, another person retaliates, the referees will definitely just send the bat to the bin. So, as I said, it's a rule that the NRL's brought in, and it seems to have worked because no punches are thrown, or no hard punches are thrown anyway, maybe a few little ones, and there was a slap as well, but that's all right.
Yeah, all right. Let's move on to the World Cup, though, because last time we spoke, we mentioned that it's always Tim Cahill who delivers. Now, that was on the money for last night, wasn't it?
That's right, and what an incredible goal as well. Obviously, the Dutch coming off a 5-1 win over Spain, obviously the world champion. So, as I said, last time we chatted, Australia actually has a really good record against the Netherlands and that we've never actually lost to them. And for Tim Cahill to 1-0 down, as everyone I'm sure knows, that Tim Cahill's goal, it will go down as, if not the goal of the tournament, one of the best. His full volley from a ball that came over his head and just cracked it into the top bar, into the ground and hit the top of the net. I'll tell you what, it would have been an incredible feeling. And then just even to score a goal against a team like that's incredible. But then obviously we went 2-1 up. From the penalty spot, Mile Jedinak, the skipper, stepping up and with nerves of steel to slot one home and put us 2-1 in front. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be that. We conceded two more and lost 3-2. But I'll tell you what, Australia was written off by pretty much everyone, including the rest of the world, not just people in Australia. And what they've done is incredible. They actually can feel pretty disappointed because both games have lost narrowly. And both games, you could probably say, they did deserve to probably come away with at least a couple of points, but it wasn't to be. Never mind, they did the country proud.
They can certainly hold their heads up in pride. Disappointing, though, that Tim Cahill was later yellow carded, so he won't be in the game against Spain.
That's right. A sign of the future it will be, because who's going to score our goals now that Tim Cahill isn't there? And he won't be there in 4 years' time, so it's time to for some of the younger boys to step up. And, you know, Matthew Leckie is just one of them that has been playing well this World Cup. I know that some big clubs are looking for his signature after his performances. So he can score. Tommy Orr might score, but, you know, it might be a blessing in disguise in that we might have to play the game without without Tim Cahill and just see how we go.
Yeah, all right. So I don't know what our chances are against Spain, but...
Well, you know, Spain hasn't won a game either. They got beaten this morning by Chile and obviously were thrashed by the Netherlands in their first game. So, you know, who knows? It's, in a way, it's a game to salvage some pride for both sides because neither of them are going to go through past this group stage. But, you know, if Australia can even score against the world champions, I mean, they've already done them proud. It doesn't really matter what happens, to be honest. They've already done themselves proud. And as you can definitely hold their heads up high.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Scott. Good to chat with you.
No worries. Thanks, Katrina.
Scott Jackson from Sky News Sport, waiting to catch up with the State of Origin team from last night. In December 2010, 50 Iranian and Iraqi asylum seekers died when their boat smashed up against the rocky cliffs of Christmas Island. Today, legal action is being launched in the New South Wales Supreme Court on behalf of those families who believe that the Australian government was responsible for their deaths. Greg Lake is a former Director of Regional and Offshore Processing with the Department of Immigration. He's held senior managerial positions at Nauru, Christmas Island, Curtin and Sherga detention centres, and he's also worked in policy and research roles. Thanks so much for sharing some of your time this morning, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
Were you working in offshore processing at the time of this incident, Greg?
I was actually on Christmas Island at the time of this incident, yes.
Oh, so what do you know about how the Australian government responded?
I think the irony of what's going on with this legal action is kind of not lost on any of us. Scott Morrison has said many times that the blood of the people who die at sea by coming by boat is on the hands of the Labor Party because of their change in policy from the Pacific Solution to a much more open policy. And what's happening now is he's come out and said he doesn't think this legal action should take place, but actually it's exactly what he should have expected given his previous comments, yeah.
So when people come to Australia by boat seeking asylum, is Australia responsible for their safety and wellbeing? What is our duty towards them?
Yeah, in international law and since the Refugee Convention, which was signed by Australia after the Second World War, we have an obligation to assess people's claims as to whether they are refugees, and their right to do that is pretty well enshrined in that law, in that international law. So it's pretty hard going to say that somebody who is coming here by whatever means, frankly, is doing something wrong or illegal by doing it, then that's something I'm a bit uncomfortable with, that language. Actually, the best way to think about it is to say, has anyone ever been convicted of a criminal offence for coming to Australia by boat? And the answer is no.
In this situation, these people who came, to some extent, of their own choice on a boat and encountered danger at Christmas Island, in your view, could the Australian government have done more about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the current government, the Abbott government, have got an opportunity now to do something which means people have a genuine option to not get on a boat. And I'd like to see Scott Morrison come out with some options which say, no, we're going to actually provide people who are genuinely on the run and don't have the option of sitting in a refugee camp for a long time with a genuine option to come to either Australia or another country where they can settle safely. That's something we should be expecting of our government now. They've stopped the boats, which is wonderful because it hopefully means none of these kinds of tragic accidents will happen again. But I'm waiting to hear what they do next.
What are your other ideas about how Australia's asylum seeker policy could be improved to be more humane?
Yeah, look, I think we need to get into our minds the idea that some refugees do have the option of sitting in a refugee camp that's run by the UNHCR. And it's not nice, but they can actually safely wait in those locations waiting resettlement. A lot of the people who are coming by boat can't do that. And I think what Australia can do is partner with countries like, say, Canada and New Zealand and other Western and developed countries and say, we're actually going to deal with this together. And we're going to go and pick up those people who are in transit on the run and can't stop somewhere safely and actually organise to resettle them, maybe in Australia, but also maybe in other countries. I think places like Canada and New Zealand would be open to resettling refugees that are picked up in places like Pakistan or Indonesia or Malaysia, as long as we also help them with some of the challenges they have with their own migration programs. I think the government could really win some points on the international stage if it came out with an innovative solution like that. And I don't think it'd be too difficult to win over those countries.
What's preventing us from doing something like that then?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure, and I plan to be asking that question myself, and I hope that many of the listeners here will do the same. We should be speaking to the government and saying, okay, you've done what you said you'd do. That's wonderful. Excellent. We really appreciate that you've stopped the boats like you promised, and now I want to see the next thing.
Yeah, okay. And as Christians, why do you think we should care about this issue, Greg?
Look, I mean, as a Christian myself, I see the gospel teaching us that Jesus loves us so deeply, he was prepared to die for us. And if God values people that much, then we're called to respond to that message of love and grace from him by loving our neighbor. And that's pretty clear in Jesus' teaching as well. So I say, if we have to love our neighbor, if we're called to love the vulnerable, then we really have an obligation to find a better way and promote a better way when it comes to dealing with really the most vulnerable people in the world. You can get there by being a Christian, which is certainly how I arrive at that position, but even people who argue from a human rights or a humanist perspective can arrive at that same spot.
Okay. And before I let you go, what's something that you learnt from your involvement of working so closely with this issue that you think that the average Australian maybe doesn't appreciate? Like, give us a sense of what, I guess, you've seen and learned from being there on Christmas Island and on Nauru and seeing how this all operates.
Yeah, look, to be honest, when I went into the job with the Department of Immigration, I didn't really care about this issue at all. I'd grown up on Sydney's North Shore, hadn't really had much experience with asylum seekers. And one of the things that really struck me from working in detention centres and knowing asylum seekers personally is that actually we're talking about a group of really vulnerable people who've just experienced unbelievable trauma. And generally speaking, they're lovely people who are keen to be part of the Australian community. And I don't think that's the flavour of the message that we hear from our politicians and from media in describing these sorts of things. They're not all perfect. Not all asylum seekers are perfect, but they're all genuinely in need of some help at the moment. And I don't think that's something that I appreciated before I went into the job, and I certainly do now.
Well, thank you so much for sharing some time with us this morning, Greg.
Yeah, thanks for having me, hey.
Last week, a giant balloon of Jesus the Redeemer was floating over Sydney, promoting betting on the World Cup. Well, according to Jared Byrne, coordinator of Problem Gambling Services with the Salvos, events like the World Cup do lead to a spike in gambling activity. So I asked him about the impact of problem gambling on Australian families.
Well, we know we're on an increase with problem gambling in Australia, and in the main, it's driven off the back of poker machines, but also the recent advent of sports bets and online betting as well.
Because it seems to me that gambling is a lot more easy to access these days. Like when I was a kid, there were certain people who went to the club every day, but they had to leave their home and make an effort. Now it seems like it's everywhere and you can bet on anything. Is that having an impact, do you think?
Look, it certainly is. I mean, two factors that we know that impact any sort of behaviour, particularly around those that have problems with that behaviour, is availability of the activity and the numbers of venues and times at which they can engage in the activity. So, you know, there are all these different types of gambling out there today, from, you know, online gambling sites to online casinos to sports betting, to the traditional horses, but also with the explosion of poker machines in the club situation as well and pub situation.
Okay. And some people can have the occasional sort of flutter without it becoming a problem, but for others it does take over. From your experience, are gambling problems something that could happen to anyone, or are there some people who are really more predisposed to it?
Well, look, they certainly can happen to anyone, and people who access our services in the Salvation Army for assistance with gambling come from all walks of life and all levels of the socioeconomic continuum are exampled within that range of clients. So it can be anyone. Once people start gambling and experience a problem with it, then there's some similarities about what happens for them.
Yeah, what does happen? What kind of impact does problem gambling have, both on the person who's addicted to it and to their loved ones?
Well, it happens in a whole range of ways. For the individual, there's certainly, you know, from the mental and emotional side of things, there's certainly things like depression and anxiety, a sense of hopelessness, isolation, difficulty in talking to people about what's happening for them. There are also the impacts on the finances, and that's often what brings the issue of gambling to the fore to start with, is the not so much the recognition of a problem, but the recognition of the fact that the finances are in a mess. And for some people, unfortunately, there may be crime involved with that as well. For families, it's often being bereft of just the capacity to meet even basic needs. I mean, we know of children who don't go to school camps and don't engage in a lot of activities that their school friends engage with simply because the family doesn't have the money to be able to do it because the household income is diverted to gambling.
Does it take food off the table for kids? I mean, does it go that far sometimes that people would go without a meal or without heating in their house because of a gambling problem?
Definitely. There is no doubt about that at all. We're assisting families through our social services centres in relation to the basics of life, you know, clothing, food and electricity bills.
Mm. And what's your view on the role of advertising this? You know, I was personally upset by this ad for a sports betting company that was, you know, on a balloon of Jesus the Redeemer and saying, keep the faith. I found that a problem on a number of levels, but even leaving the religious part of it aside, the idea of encouraging people to take a bet and sort of keep the faith, take a bet, seems like a very dangerous message to be sending. Do you think advertising does have an impact on problem gambling?
If the research wasn't there to show that advertising had an impact on gambling, then gambling providers would not be investing money in it. So we know that it does, and we know that in instances where they're tying their type of gaming to a particular event that might be occurring in this instance, you know, the Soccer World Cup, that there will be a spike in the gambling that occurs in relation to that.
You guys are picking up the pieces of problem gambling and helping people to get out of it. How do you help people to overcome gambling?
Well, I think it's encouraging people to, you know, step forward and talk to someone about it, you know, to not be quiet about it, because there are things like, and that includes families as well, not just the gambler, but there are things like, you know, as I said, depression, anxiety and isolation that actually impact on the person and on the family, and that, in a sense, feed the gambling problem because it keeps it hidden. So I want to encourage people to understand that there's no shame in stepping forward and asking for help.
Okay.
You know, we're here, the Salvation Army is here to help people who fall foul of their gambling and to help their families. So that's the first thing, step forward. There's information available on our services at salvos.org.au, and the good thing about the web is these days people can sit there and look at it, and they can be anonymous, and so they can take the information in if they want to. If they go to salvos.org.au/recovery, then there's a self-referral facility in there, so people can type in a little bit of information and someone from one of our services discreetly will get in touch with them.
Okay, that's good. Thanks so much for giving us that option.
Yeah. No,
that's
worries.
Jared Byrne. He's the coordinator of problem gambling services with the Salvation Army. How much do you know about the illicit drug that is most likely to be used by young people? According to a new survey by the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre, over 65% of parents are kind of foggy on the facts around the effects of using cannabis. Dr. Peter Gates is from the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre at the Uni of New South Wales. Hi, Dr. Gates.
Hello.
Firstly, how widespread is cannabis use among Aussie teens?
Well, I can answer that question just from our national census survey. So if you're looking at lifetime use for those that are 18 to 29 years, it's around 30 to 45%. Teenagers only, so 12 to 17 years, it's about 11% lifetime use. If you're talking about recent use, so used in the last 12 months, again, that 12 to 17 year age group, it's about 8.8% of the population, to be precise.
Okay, so they're probably the regular users in that age group.
That's any use in the last 12 months.
Okay.
So most typically, they would be using once or twice in the year.
Oh, okay, rightio. And so what are some of the problems associated with smoking dope or using cannabis?
Sure, well, I mean, firstly, what's key with the harms associated with cannabis use is how old you are when you first start using and how heavily you use.
Okay.
So if you combine an early age of onset, we call it, and using heavily, then you're more at risk of physical harms, like to your respiratory health, same as tobacco, and mental health harms, you're more at risk of developing things like depression, psychosis, schizophrenia, it gets pretty serious. And then cannabis use compared to non-use is associated with poorer education results, more likely to be unemployed, and of course using, you're more likely to be at risk of developing addiction to cannabis dependence.
Okay, there was always this myth when I was young that it wasn't addictive. Has that now been disproved?
Cannabis is an indeed addictive drug, yeah. So, I mean, if you look at the statistics of those who use cannabis, 1 in 10 of them will be diagnosed with a cannabis use disorder. So it's what we call dependence or abuse of cannabis.
Okay.
So it is an addictive drug, yes.
And it seems to have been particularly the mental health issues that have come to the fore lately. I mean, are they just associated with people who use it for a long period of time, or what's the connection between marijuana use and mental health outcomes?
Well, like I said, the key in the research is how early you start to use and how heavily you use. So if you combine those two things, then you are more at risk. There is research that shows just any use compared to no use increasing the risk, but the major problem is early and frequent use.
All right. And do you have any suggestions for how parents should talk to their kids about this issue?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if there is a parent out there that's struggling in particular, we do have a helpline that they can call, a cannabis information helpline. It's on 1-800-30-40-50. But generally, we're trying to encourage parents to have conversations that are ongoing. So to start them early and have them often, to remain calm and open, honest. And we're just trying to avoid things like ultimatums, lecturing and blaming the child. So not saying things like stop using or you're out, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay, that's not generally the best approach.
No, just be non-judgmental.
Okay, but do we know if kids are influenced by their parents on this issue?
Well, in particular from this survey that we did with 1,000 parents of teenage kids, we found that about a quarter of the kids were approaching their parents for information. And also we knew that the vast majority of parents believed that they should be the primary source of informing their kids on drugs.
Okay, so what can parents do then to get more informed?
I'm glad you asked that. We do encourage the parents to approach our website at ncpic.org.au. And again, our helpline, the Cannabis Information Helpline, 1-800-30-40-50, are two great sources to approach. We do have free resources available there.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for filling us in today. It's been good to talk to you and get some facts, really.
Yeah, it's about the facts. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Okay, that's Dr. Peter Gates. He's from the National Cannabis Prevention and Information Centre. We've been talking to him for Drug Action Week. That helpline, again, is 1-800-30-40-50. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City joins me to talk about a topic that for women is often as fraught as romance, and it's that of friendship. Now, Joanna, you're someone who lives alone. Does that make friendships even more important?
Yeah, absolutely. Friendship is really important for me. My friends are my family, basically.
Yeah.
And the only reason that I leave my house on the weekend. So,
yeah, so you need to keep those friendships alive and well. How do you do that? How do you create and maintain good friendships?
Well, I think one of the main things is building trust. So I take a long time to trust someone.
Oh, yes, so do I.
So, yeah, but it's also not going to magically happen if you, like, never spend time with anyone. And so I think, you know, one of the important things is actually spending time with people. It helps if you go through something intense together, like a shipwreck.
But, it's hard to engineer those moments, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I wouldn't, like, try to construct that. we're going on holidays and then, but spending some time with the person is really important. And look, sometimes on the rare occasion, you just feel like you've already known someone forever, which is wonderful. But in general, you have to actually build trust, and that takes time.
That's true. And often those friendships that you have known someone for a long time, then you're fine just catching up once every 6 months and you pick up where you left off. But
absolutely.
That's because you've kind of got that history,
Yeah, the bond is there, I guess. Much more tenuous at the beginning and therefore needs a bit more care, I think.
Okay. Now, I know that a lot of women in particular sometimes have this conflict between the people that are around them right now and those old friendships that they really value. And internet and Facebook is kind of meaning that we can sort of stay in touch for a lot longer and yet we may not actually be maintaining a real friendship.
Yeah, so one of the things that I guess is strange for me, although it's not an uncommon experience, I moved heaps as a child. I've moved a lot again as an adult. And so I was quite used to, okay, this friendship is over now because we are not in proximity to one another anymore. And we're not exactly friends, soulmates. So, you know, we can let this just die peacefully. the internet has sort of ruined that, though. I feel like we have this sense of obligation because we can keep in contact with people much more easily. We should, which just makes it difficult because then, well, I've also also got people actually in my life at the moment that I'm trying to be friends with. And that's really hard to maintain all of my old friendships, all of my new ones, and still also actually, like, do my job and catch up with my family. And
it's so true with churches and home groups and things as well, isn't it? That, you know, a home group ends and then you're trying to keep up with all the members of your old home group as well as your new one, or people leave the church and you're trying to keep up with them, but then you don't have time for the people who are in your church now.
Yes, it's very challenging. And I think last time I checked, psychologists reckon you can have 3 deep friendships and a circle of about 70 people at most that you can sort of actually catch up with and know things about one another, which particularly for Christians in many senses is not that many people at all.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think we max out a lot more quickly than we're happy to acknowledge, because we love people and we want them to know that we love them and that we still care for them. Sometimes I think we're unwilling to just let a friendship move on to its next stage, which is the stage where you don't see it.
No, it's so true. It's so true what you're saying, that you love and value a person, and so we want them to know that we love and value them, but sometimes that means we're probably hanging on to friendships that we really probably do need to let go of. Yeah.
And I think what I've tried to learn, and particularly because quite like a few of my really deep close friends do live far away from me, but they're the ones where it's at the point where we can catch up every few months and still be a meaningful encounter, but we also are aware of that we've got people in our lives right now. I'm not saying that you can't keep up with friends after you've moved away from each other or are no longer, you know, present in one another's lives. But I just think there's a whole lot of friendships where we can just part peacefully and let it move on, and that is okay. And it doesn't mean you're a bad person because you're not keeping up with the 460 different people you've been at church with.
Oh, I just have a feeling that's going to be a huge weight off a lot of people's shoulders.
I hope so.
I'm one of them, always carrying around that guilty feeling, oh, I haven't called so-and-so for a while, and I'm always carrying that around with me. And
it's the magic of someone pointing out, well, they haven't called you either. And it also doesn't mean that they hate you. It just means they have lots of people and things and demands and difficulties in their life right now, which means that they're needing to devote some time to the people actually there, and that's fine.
That's good, Joanna. Thanks for that. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City saying, look, it's okay to let go of a few friendships every now and then. Thanks for that. Katrina Rowe with you. Now, if you're getting the impression that your friends are crazy about Instagram and you have seen just one too many photos of your neighbour's children or holidays or puppies or whatever, you're not wrong. More than 1.8 billion photos are being shared every day. That's just one of the mind-boggling statistics to emerge from Mary Meeker's 2014 Internet Trends Report. Andrew Webb, Guy Morris, our new media manager, is about to bamboozle us with more technology statistics.
Hopefully not bamboozle, but yeah, you said it so quickly, 1.8 billion photos shared every day,
it's
uploaded.
Ridiculous. I mean, they cannot all be interesting. It's just impossible.
That is why the internet is polluted with information. Because we're just shoving stuff up faster and faster every day, whether it's photos and videos. Yeah, it's quite amazing. Now, this is an annual report. Her name is Mary Meeker. She's
Who is she? Never heard of the report.
Yeah, okay. So she is a tech analyst. She works for a venture capital firm. So venture capital, you know, basically they look for great new creative potential businesses, and they inject money into that to start that business up with the idea that they'll benefit and reap a reward when that company floats or does really well.
So they're looking for opportunities, really.
Yeah. She works for a venture capital firm called Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. Like, if you look at her presentations, they're full of graphs and numbers, and the tech industry looks at her because she's isolating things, looking at trends and forecasting possible future things. So basically, yeah, she said, hey, mobile is just going off. An example is with the uploading of photos. Tablet sales are growing faster than desktop and mobile phones and laptops have ever sold. And so those announcements and the fact that mobile phones now have so many sensors. So she makes the example that the Samsung Galaxy S5 has 10 separate sensors on it, which can do a barometer, fingerprints, a heart rate monitor, all that information companies can use.
So what happens with that? I mean, because one of the most interesting aspects aspects of all these new apps is the data mining. Where's that going
okay.
right now?
So, yeah, data mining. Businesses are all into data. Big data is what all businesses talk about. And basically, when you subscribe to a service or you make a donation or you buy something, the company has information about your name, your sex, all the demographic information. If they don't, they'll send you an email and ask you for a bit more information. Businesses or people, if you download an app like Angry Birds, they can see where you are.
Is this information actually being effectively utilized?
A lot of businesses probably wouldn't use that information, but some of your big businesses would be getting in and trying to find out about their consumers.
Yeah.
So trying to study, okay, Katrina does this, she likes this, she looks at these pages on this website, she does all this kind of stuff, and they build a picture of what you look like, and then they can target products towards you with the idea of helping you, and all that kind of stuff. So it's all about learning more about the consumer.
Now, another, I guess, interesting aspect of this is the way that technology is impacting on the way that we communicate. You know, what direction's that moving in?
Well, she's saying that people who are creating apps, we're sharing content with a narrow group of people. So, like, rather than just saying, you're sending out a message about, you know, my new baby girl or my birthday party
for
child.
Which is what kind of social media started as, wasn't it? Just broadcasting,
yeah.
Hey, I'm doing this.
Yeah, it's like what we do on the radio. We broadcast to a whole mass of people.
Yeah.
But she's saying that there's a trend now to target a specific, you know, I'll send you a picture of my child's birthday just to you and a small group of other people, like-minded people or something
like
that.
Yeah. So it's like becoming a more like,
personalised, yeah. More segmented, more targeted rather than just saying, hey, everyone, check this out. So, and Facebook's making us do that anyway because if you engage with my photos on Facebook, mm-hmm. you'll see my posts more regularly. But if you don't look at my posts on a regular basis, then I'll disappear from your newsfeed.
Yeah, right.
So some companies are forcing that upon us anyway. The other thing is she's talking about, the declining cost of computing. So we see it every time we walk into the shops, you know, phones, desktops, storage, everything about technology is cheaper. And that just continues to decrease. And it's amazing what you get for your dollar these days.
Yeah, that's certainly probably part of the popularity of these tablets is that, you know, you can grab one, you can take it anywhere, and it's affordable for everyone to have one, really. So.
And the other thing is a term called dual screening. And I know I do this at home. I've got the television on watching something and I've got my...
Oh, that is so annoying.
I've got my tablet
My husband
going.
Does that all the time.
Sometimes I've got my desktop, my laptop going as well. So I've got three screens going. And she's found that 84% of American mobile users are using their device while watching TV. You could put that into tablet as well. So we're multitasking. How effective we are at doing all these different things, who knows? But
okay.
So basically tech firms are using all this information that she's brought out to look at products for the future and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all right. Well, thanks, Andrew, for telling us a little bit about it today.
Yep.
Andrew Morris, our new media manager there, talking about Mary Meeker's 2014 Internet Trends Report. DreamWorks have released their latest 3D animation in time for the American summer. How to Train Your Dragon 2 is showing now. To fill us in on the next installment of the adventures of Hiccup and Toothless, I'm joined by film reviewer Mark Hadley. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you going?
Now, the Vikings and the dragons have made friends and are living in peace now, so I'm sure that something is going to disturb that peace. What happens next?
Well, basically, you know, we've been following Hiccup as a boy in his journey of life. And so in the first film, as you know, he was the misfit and he moved into a space that finally he could occupy, you know, where the quirky intelligence that he had and his inventive skills made sense. And once he'd made friends with, you know, Toothless, there it was. He was leading the village. He found his place. But quite strangely, and in fact, I think actually quite significantly for Australian audiences, he's now, as a boy, moving into a new space. Well, I found my place in my village, but where is my place in my life? You know, where is my place in my family in particular? So this story, what we see is him actually come into contact with his mum. Most people will realise, if they've seen the film, that he really only had his dad on the scene, and it's never really explained what happened to mum. But mum, Valka, turns up, and she's voiced by Kate Blanchett. And it's basically, if you like, a sort of a family reunion. Now, I don't want to go into the plot because I don't want to give away all sorts of things that happen. But it's really interesting from an Australian family perspective. You know, about 7% of all Australian families with children in Australia are blended families where mum and dad, there might be new mums and dads, mum and dad are off the scene, things like that for a wide variety of reasons. Mm. And kids are really sort of in this space. It's not now in our society just about finding out where you belong in society, what your purpose is. But does my mum really love me? You know, does my dad love me? Do I have a place in my own family? So from this perspective, I actually think this is a very timely film. You know, we're looking at something, you know, with How to Train Your Dragon that is not just about, you know, the usual sort of neatly packaged hero turns up on story, bad guy turns up, how will hero defeat the bad guy? Oh, here's the secret in the end, and there you go. Instead, this is a very open-ended story. So DreamWorks have been quite clear on the fact that this is the first of three films.
The fact that this is based on a young adult book series by Cressida Cowell, you know, normally films that are based on books have a really strong plot line because, you know, a book can't just fall back on big-name actors and special effects. It kind of has to have a story that carries it along. So does that give this film a certain strength in that it has got something more to it?
Without a doubt, because basically you know that there's a certain depth behind it. And, in fact, I think it's part. It's quite an accepted part of the whole sort of book series. And Dean DeBlois, who's the guy who's directing it, actually said, look, I don't want to come on and just do the next film. The deal of him coming on has been basically that he will do not this film, but the next film as well.
Mm-hmm.
He sets it up as he says this is something like of an Empire Strikes Back film. Yeah. So we're going to have a look in the inner turmoil of what is really Hiccup's life, and then we're going to look for the solution a little further on. So you'll get, there is a curve, there is a villain, you know, you're going to see some interesting things happen, but don't look for an easy solution. I think for parents, if you're going into this one, this is great film territory because it helps to explain to kids, you know, that not every family looks the same way and what exactly is a dad and a mum supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's one you'd recommend for the school holidays then.
Look, I'd recommend it, but I'd just say with this caveat, okay, is that sometimes these things get tied up a little neater than they do in life.
Mm.
You know, and that's the thing that I want to be careful about because life is full of all sorts of sadness and Hollywood likes to abbreviate some of the struggles we have to go through.
Thanks, Mark. It's a really poignant review. Thank you.
No worries.
Okay, that's Mark Hadley, our film reviewer, talking about How to Train Your Dragon, How to Train.
Have it.
It's a tongue twister, Mark. How to Train Your Dragon 2.